Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the SWP podcast, bringing you the latest from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin. This is a podcast about what's on the minds of policymakers, or at least should be on their minds, when it comes to the most pressing global issues of the day. Today is Monday, the 22nd of March, 2021, and we're looking to Libya. After years of conflict and instability, the divided North African country is getting a unity government, led by a three-member presidency council and a new prime minister. They're meant to pave the way for general elections later this year. This is being seen as a major breakthrough, but significant challenges remain, and the unity government might not be so unified after all. What these developments mean for Libya and the broader region, today on the SWP podcast. I'm William Gluckroft, a journalist based in Berlin, and I'm joined today by two great guests. On the line from London is Elham Saudi, a human rights lawyer. Elham is co-founder and director of Lawyers for Justice in Libya. She's also a member of the UN-backed Libyan Political Dialogue Forum. Welcome, Elham.
Hi, it's really great to be here.
And then we have SWP's own Wolfram Lacher, a senior associate whose research focuses on conflicts in Libya and the Sahel region. He's the author of Libya's Fragmentation, which was published by IB Taurus last year. Hello to you, Wolfram.
Hi, William. Hi, Elham.
Let's turn first to you, Elham. Is this the historic moment people in Libya and Libya watchers have been waiting for? How do you see it?
I think anytime you build something like that, you're dooming it to fail. I think it's an important moment. It's a noteworthy moment. It's difficult to tell if something historic at its outset. I think what is important about it is that this is the first government to go through the box-ticking exercise of being approved by all the bodies it needs to be approved by to be constituted as a government. So this, we can say, is the first legally constituted government we've had in over 6 years. Whether this will be historic or not, I think, has to do with how it performs as opposed to just its sheer existence.
So it definitely checks all the boxes, at least on paper. Wolfram, is that how you see things?
Yes, I think it is a political breakthrough. It's also a very surprising breakthrough in many ways. But it's also a breakthrough that is based on a very limited understanding for now. The understanding being that political factions will compete for access to state resources in a unity government. But exactly who gets what remains to be negotiated, and the substantive issues that go beyond the distribution of spoils have been left aside for now. Who should lead the army? Which armed groups should be considered army and which ones should be considered militias? How people should be held to account for crimes committed in the conflicts? So the agreement is fragile, both because competition over state resources could become quite intense in this government, and because the underlying issues in the conflict are not being addressed yet.
Tell us more, Wolfram, about who is in this unity government. What do we need to know about them?
Well, first, there is a presidency council of three members, one for each of Libya's regions, east, west, and south. But that presidency council has limited competencies, and it's so far played a largely symbolic role, whereas the real politics is being conducted by the new prime minister, Abdelhamid Dbeibah, who is a controversial figure because he and his cousin Ali Dbeibah became immensely rich during the Gaddafi era when they were at the head of state-owned companies and institutions. And because he is controversial, it's even more remarkable how he has been able to transcend Libya's political divides. The actual process of government formation, the selection of the ministers, took place in negotiations between Dbeibah and the parliament, the House of Representatives that was elected in 2014, that had been largely defunct and divided over the last years and remains divided to some extent. And members of that parliament openly demanded shares in that government in the name of their cities and tribes, even though it's highly questionable to what extent they actually do represent these constituencies. And so the way Dbeibah managed to get his government through the House of Representatives was by giving small groups of parliamentarians or even individual parliamentarians their own ministers, which is how he got to a government of 35 members. The members of parliament pursued their own parochial interest in government formation, which are very different from the interests of the armed groups that fought in the most recent war on both sides. These armed groups largely stood aside to allow government formation to happen. The government now needs to take positions towards these groups and strike arrangements. And negotiating these arrangements with these competing and conflicting forces will be very, very tricky.
Well, Wolfram's pointed out all the things that haven't really been figured out, all the issues that have been kicked down the road to be decided later. So what exactly is this government supposed to do?
I think what's really important, if you're looking for a historic moment or if you're looking for significance, is to see who is not in government today, as opposed to who is in government and what their likely reactions will be to this government. Because I think it is a unity government in the extent that, yes, it is vast enough and it's big enough as a cabinet to include people from various factions that were previously disenfranchised. And so you'll see for the first time, really since 2011, a presence of people who were perceived to be loyal to the Gaddafi regime, which is obviously a positive step towards healing the country. You will see people who were very much pushed for by certain members of the House of Representatives, the parliament in Libya, to get their access into it. But you will also see that there were people that were not included in this configuration. And I think that is where the real conversation is. And those are the spaces to watch. Because one thing that this unity government has not demonstrated very clearly is its control on the armed groups in the country, on its ability to influence them. We've already seen some disturbances coming out of Benghazi over the last couple of days, already hinting at the unity government not representing people there. But I think what's really important to look at here is what this government is creating in terms of perception, because sometimes the perception can help influence the reality on the ground. The perception is there are photos coming out. It's a multicolored political government. They seem to have convened. They seem to have appointed people. It's looking the part. But let's see how that perception manifests itself, because I fear that, as Wolfram said, there is a couple of key positions that have been left unspoken. Well, key amongst them is the Ministry of Defense, which the Prime Minister has kept for himself now because it would be too difficult to decide on who should occupy that position.
So, Wilhelm, the picture that Elam paints is that the divisions or the challenges might be bigger than the unity. Is that an accurate way to describe the situation?
Yes, I think so. I mean, first of all, key institutions remain divided for now. Most importantly, the central bank and military command structures, as Elham already mentioned. And as long as they remain divided, unification is quite easily reversible. I think there is currently no real process to deal with the divisions in the security sector. There is a committee of five military officers from each side, but they clearly do not have the political mandate or the political support to work on military unification. My sense of the process that has brought about the new government is that it has been overwhelmingly driven by the motivation to divide the spoils, and mostly driven by people who have not suffered from the conflicts of the past years but benefited from them, and whom constituencies who have suffered do not see as representing them. Reconciliation, we heard during this process, to me has sounded quite vacuous.
Absolutely. I think there is anything to take away in this is that the absolute victor of this entire process is the culture of impunity that we have in Libya. The emphasis is on reconciliation in a very unsatisfactory way. Read for reconciliation amnesty, effectively. What's being asked of people is forgiveness without any accountability, without truth, without any of the pillars of transitional justice. And that kind of setup is only ever asking for the work to be done by the victims. You as a victim need to get over this and move on. You need to forgive for the sake of the greater good. You need to get over your own private need for justice, your right to justice, your right to truth, your right to reparations for the greater good. Absolutely zero pressure on perpetrators in this formulation to own up to their deeds, to confess, to tell the truth, to be held accountable, to pay reparations. None of that. It's a very lopsided equation and a very lopsided process that is envisaged. And we saw that reaffirmed by Aguila Saleh, the head of parliament, last week when they gave the vote of confidence to the government. And the exact words he said is, we need to turn the page and forget the past. And I think forgetfulness is only a recipe for repetition. And that's what we've seen in Libya's history time and time and time again. And it is an absolute travesty and a discredit to the sacrifices that the victims have been made to put the burden on them to get the country through this phase instead of on the perpetrators.
Now, can you be more specific? Who exactly are the perpetrators and the victims in Libya?
If we're talking about two sides to the past conflicts, both sides are implicated in grave human rights violations, war crimes and crimes against humanity. The legacy of the migrant crisis in Libya and what has happened to migrants coming through the country in terms of torture and enslavement and extrajudicial executions and the like. But everyone who's an activist in Libya or who has spoken up against a political side in Libya has suffered in the last 11 years. And I think it is absolutely vital that instead of silencing people, and we've seen that through legal mechanisms, we've seen that through forced disappearances in the country, we've seen that through the extrajudicial executions in the country. And so for us to go through the perpetrators, there needs to be a genuine process of transitional justice that also includes truth-seeking, truth-telling, and accountability. And I think if we expedite that process for the sake of a false perception of unity and a coming together of the country, what you'll find is that will be very short-lived. And actually, Lawyers for Justice in Libya, the organization I work for, has just done a very comprehensive survey of perceptions of justice amongst Libyans across the country. And the overwhelming result of that research is that most people equate justice with accountability. And, and that's not what the politicians are telling us Libyans want for justice.
So everything you lay out here, this is not happening in a vacuum, of course. Libya is part of a bigger region. A lot of international actors involved here, maybe for better, maybe for worse. Wolfram, can you outline some of that? Where is the international community in everything that Elham has described?
One of the reasons why the successful formation of this government was so surprising was that the foreign meddlers involved in Libya, such as Turkey, Russia, the United Arab Emirates, didn't undermine the process as one could have expected them to do, because these states established a presence in Libya and exerted influence in Libya because Libya was divided, and therefore a united Libya should be expected to threaten their interest, because a united Libyan government could force them and their mercenaries to leave the country. But they did not. They did not torpedo the process. And in fact, Egypt and Turkey supported the process. It raises the question why foreign meddlers are allowing this to happen. And for me, the most plausible answers to this question is that they do not see a risk that this government could genuinely unite Libyans, and that therefore they don't fear this government, because the formation of this unity government clearly hasn't resolved the problem of distrust between the conflicting parties. The formation of this government is supposed to pave the way for elections, but in reality, the formation of this government has probably made elections or progress towards elections much more difficult, because not only the government itself will want to hold on to power for as long as possible, there are already signs for that, but the parliamentarians who have just placed their ministers in positions in this government will now want to benefit to the maximum from the access to state funds that these ministers offer, and therefore it's very unlikely that these parliamentarians will vote for the constitutional basis and the electoral law needed for elections.
One of the bizarre criteria for the election that has already been kind of predetermined is that those who are in this government cannot run in the forthcoming election, which, if there's ever a disincentive for someone not to hold an election, that's it right there, right? You're telling people, we've given you a job. The only way you keep it is by not doing your job of getting us to an election. And so you've incentivized people to effectively not deliver on the one job they're meant to deliver on, because that's the only way they stay in power. Whereas perhaps if there was the opportunity to run for an election, that might incentivize them to do their job well so that they could get reelected. But at the moment, you have a government that is not unified. It's a collection of people trying to get us to an election where they have no ability to access the result of that election. It's asking way too much of human nature to be that magnanimous, I think. And so for me, that only asks them to either hold on to power by force or abuse this period as much as possible to enrich themselves. And both are possible outcomes.
I see a new political crisis in the making because the whole process is predicated on the idea that there will be elections. And the elections are why many people accepted the formation of this government in the first place. But if no progress happens towards elections as time passes, I think we will see growing opposition and mobilization against this government. The Libyan public expects elections. They've been promised elections. Many political actors who have stood aside to allow the formation of this government to happen expect elections. And elections are desperately needed because there is no body that enjoys popular legitimacy in Libya today.
What are the steps that have to happen for this plan that's been put forward to actually maybe have some chance at succeeding?
For meaningful elections to occur, you need a proper enfranchisement of citizens. You need safety, genuine safety for people to express their views. Here, we obviously think especially of people who have been politically disenfranchised. So those who are political minorities or who are outside the scene, but also ethnic minorities in Libya's makeup who might not have the necessary paperwork. Certain classes of women who are, for example, women married to non-Libyans are not able to vote because of the system and how it's set up. But there's a lot of absolutely necessary rights that need to be worked on and guaranteed for this to be a meaningful election. We can still have an election without those, but whether that's a genuine mandate by the people will be certainly a different angle. And for me, as a human rights lawyer, my obsession is with how and not what, because I think a lot of the times we see an election as an end in its own, like that's it. You know, the goal of this process is to get to elections. Well, not really, actually. The end of this process is to get to stability and to get to credibility and to get to legitimacy in our government structures. And so if we end up orchestrating a process that only gets us the optics of an election, which is exactly how everything we've done in Libya to date is, it's all about the optics. I want a little bit more depth on this. And you know, the frustration for me as a member of the LPDF is that it's all been dictated by milestones and photo opportunities and press conferences and really kind of the superficial. It's not a reassuring process that led us to this unity government. And if we're going to take the same approach of saying what matters is come 24th of December, we can get photos of Libyans standing in queues to vote and that's the victory, then that is a really problematic picture, because what you're going to be getting are people who are not representative of the country or of its population at the very least.
Then is it too late? Is this already a foregone conclusion? Is there anything that can be done to ensure this doesn't happen, what you're describing?
Yes. I think the international community needs to play its role now. They have adopted this process, this LPDF process, and they seem to have abandoned it. And as a member in it, since the day in Geneva where this government was elected, there has been zero interaction between the LPDF and the UN or the LPDF and external actors. As far as they're concerned, it appears to me that our role is done. And now we hand over to these sovereign institutions. You know, the part of the marketing of this whole process is that this, you know, political process is Libyan-led and Libyan-owned. What we see at the moment, time and time again, is when it goes well, the UN is happy to take credit for this process. And when it goes badly, is when it's Libyan-led and Libyan-owned. What we're seeing is actually within the LPDF, and as a member myself, we are very vocal and very demanding at the moment, saying we need to be overseeing this process. The constitutional basis does not exist. What happens next? And there's been a lot of pushback from members within that, trying to genuinely take Libyan ownership and Libyan leadership of this. And so what I fear is going to be a situation where under this guise of we don't want to meddle, we want to allow Libyan sovereignty, you're actually depriving, if you like, Libyan ownership of the political process at that price. And then you end up in a situation where you're still rewarding the same people that you had specifically labeled as spoilers and actually sanctioned as spoilers several years prior. At the moment, the perception of success is being celebrated at the price of the reality of danger that's coming.
All right, let's wrap now with two final questions, one to each of you. And that's, of course, stakes. It might seem very obvious what's at stake here. But I think it's also just as important to really clarify who wins, who loses, who's affected by either success or failure in the political process here in Libya. So, Wolfram, it might feel to us in Berlin as this is a faraway issue, but Libya is on the European Union's doorstep. What does it mean for us here in Germany, here in the EU?
Europeans have been looking at Libya primarily through the angle of migration for the last few years. That has been the biggest issue. Policymakers have understood in the last few years that there is no direct link between the numbers of people arriving via Libya in Europe on the one hand and the conflicts on the other hand. You had the formation of a previous unity government in 2016, which didn't manage to unify the country, didn't manage to exert control, but nevertheless helped Europeans to reduce the numbers of migrants arriving to Europe significantly. Today, I think Libya is seen more through the prism of geopolitics, and Europeans would like to see foreign forces and foreign mercenaries leave the country, would like to see a reduction of Russian and Turkish influence in particular. But I'm not sure that anyone is hugely optimistic that this government is the way of getting there.
To you, Elham, people on the ground in Libya, what's at stake for them?
Their lives, it's their livelihoods, it's their rights, it's their safety. From every perspective, whether it's the risk of the health crisis that we're all facing in the world and the inability of previous governments, and we hope this one will be different, but to deal with that, the fact that people have been disenfranchised politically for decades, really, and for most people, their entire lives. You know, the majority of civil society is operating from outside the country now due to the situation on the ground, if they haven't been disappeared or killed. And there is no light for us as people, as citizens. I don't see myself as anything other than a citizen when I speak. All this injustice that we've suffered, the people who have perpetrated it are being rewarded for it and are being forgiven without our permission for it and are getting the spoils for it. It is high stakes because it is so vital that we get this right this time, because what's at stake is not a deal or a compromise or a contract or whatever it might be that is motivating the big players outside the scene. It's the people on the ground that I represent in my work as a lawyer, but also myself. I want to be able to go home, and I want to be able to vote, and I want to be able to take my daughter to her home and explain to her what Libya is beyond the concept that I do at home. So it is very emotional for us. It is very real for us. And when we have these discussions and we pontificate and we give theories, actually, what we're talking about is people's lives. It's not complicated. It's really simple. People's lives, people's rights. That's what's at stake here.
That is certainly a lot to look at, to deal with, to process over the next weeks and months as Libya heads towards some sort of general elections. But that is where we're going to have to leave it here today for this episode of the SWP podcast. Let me thank my guests, SWP's senior associate Wolfram Lacher and Elham Saudi, whose own podcast, Libya Matters, is on Apple, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. And you should look out for a special season that marks the 10th anniversary of the Libyan uprising and the role of civil society that's coming out later this year. You can subscribe to this podcast on SoundCloud and Spotify, or check out swp-berlin.org for more from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. From Berlin, I'm William Gluckroft. Until next time, thanks for listening.